Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 151 on Lys Amphibian Origins with Ben Klickman of Petrified Forest National Park and Virginia Tech. If you're new to PaleoCast, we are a show that digs deep into the fossil record and brings you detailed discussions of paleontological research with the researchers themselves. We attempt to cover the whole paleontological field so that there's always some new group of organisms that I'm only just learning about for the very first time, or new insights into a group that changes my perceptions of them just as I thought I had them all figured out. And where we can, we also love to bring you the most comprehensive overviews of new studies the moment they're released, so that the only way that you can get this information faster or in more detail is if you speed read the scientific papers themselves. This episode is both of those things, a look at a new species of Sicilian from the Triassic, and what its discovery means for our understanding of the origins of all living amphibians, all on the very same day that the paper is released in Nature. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd never even heard of a Sicilian before, but they're absolutely fascinating creatures, and so in the first part of this interview, we're looking at what they are, which are the groups they're related to, how they live their lives, and why their fossil record is so poor. Then, in the second half, which is also available today, we're looking at the details of this new discovery, what the fossil species is like, what it can tell us about the evolution of both Sicilians and their unique burrowing lifestyles, and then we ponder the absolute mystery of why so many lower right jaws have been found. Releasing an episode to coincide with a press release is a collaborative effort, so I'd like to thank Ben for all the time he's spent on this, whilst also defending his PhD. And I'd like to take a minute to reiterate that we're always open to researchers coming to us with their latest work, but also for listeners to submit episode requests and for potential collaborations with other content creators. Our door is always open. We love to share our love of paleontology and especially of paleontological podcasts, and so what better way to do that than by shining the spotlight on other shows in our Paleo podcast plug, so please check this one out and see what they have to offer.
Hello everybody and welcome to I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. Our show is hosted by Gavin, a vertebrate paleontologist, Fia, an ecologist, and Mike, a high school history teacher who knows nothing about science. Each episode, Gavin breaks down an aspect of paleontology, while Mike and Fia make sure that everyday people can listen through all the jargon. If you're paleo-curious, but don't want to read through heaps of literature to understand one group of life or a single event in Earth's history, this is the show for you. You can find us wherever pods are cast, or check us out on anchor.fm/dead-podcast, where you can leave us voice messages that will sometimes make it into the episodes themselves. A big thanks to Dave and all the folks that make PaleoCast happen for giving us a platform to reach some more people. We're very excited to see where our show goes in this new year, and hopefully you'll be there along the way. So with that, back to you, Dave.
To our Patreon backers, you can expect to find a couple of new videos in the next week or so, which is about 2 hours of new video content. And it features an update with Melanie During on her work at Tanis and that fateful day at the end of the Cretaceous, and the subsequent controversy surrounding this work, which you may have already seen in the news. Plus, I'll also be catching up with PaleoCast team member Tom Fletcher, who's taken up a permanent role as a senior scientific researcher with a documentary production company, and we say everything we're legally allowed to say about PaleoCast's role in the creation of life on our planet, which is Netflix's forthcoming paleontological documentary that will be out later this year. Unfortunately, despite my best efforts to establish myself as the voice of paleontology, for narration they've opted to go with Morgan Freeman, for some reason. Well, if he were here today, I am sure he'd tell you with his authoritative voice to check out our website for all of the media that accompanies this episode, and to like, share, and subscribe to us anywhere where you can like, share, and subscribe, and that he'd hope you'll enjoy the first part of this episode. Hi, Ben. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So we want to get to know you first. So can you give us an introduction to yourself, your background, and how you got into the field of paleontology?
Sure. Yeah. So currently I'm a PhD candidate at Virginia Tech, and I'm in my final year and final few months. So I'll be defending my dissertation in maybe March or April. So I am a PhD student during the school year, and in the summers I work as a ranger for the National Park Service at Petrified Forest National Park. And so that's where I'm working in the summer, collecting the data that I am studying for my PhD. So that's what I'm doing, who I am and what I'm doing currently. How did I get into paleontology? I've always been kind of interested in nature and rocks and minerals ever since I was a little kid. And there's pictures of me from my parents of me like looking at books of dinosaurs and stuff, but I didn't really get into paleontology specifically until I was in high school, when I learned that there were dinosaur fossils and other fossils that I could find virtually in my backyard. So I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania in the United States. And in that part of Pennsylvania, there's the Newark Basin, which is a rift basin from the Triassic and early Jurassic that is exposed today and has lots of different fossils, mostly footprints. And so when I was in high school, I learned that there were dinosaur trackways found near my house. And so I started to take my bicycle and bike around on bike paths and basically look at outcrops and try to find footprints and fish fossils. And I was trying to read the literature about those fossils. I got very obsessed and spent a lot of my high school looking for fossils and trying to read geologic and paleontological literature to understand what I was looking at. And I got really interested in the early Mesozoic, so the Triassic and the early Jurassic, because those were the rocks kind of in my backyard. And I got really fascinated by seeing how like the different types of footprints that you can see, they change through the sequence of the late Triassic into the lower Jurassic in Southeast Pennsylvania. And I thought it was really cool how you could basically go to an outcrop of rock and put your finger on the layers of rock that are the end of the Triassic and the beginning of the Jurassic, when we have this one of the Earth's major mass extinctions. And that was something that once I kind of understood how you could read the rocks and look at how ecosystems are changing and how the animals living there are changing through time, I became utterly obsessed, and that obsession has never left me till today and probably will never leave me.
Good. Did you ever find a dinosaur trackway?
I found dinosaur footprints and footprints from lots of other tetrapods and invertebrates and fish fossils. I definitely found fossils. The footprints are actually fairly common if you know what they look like and where to look for them. The non-footprint fossils, especially tetrapods in the Newark Basin, are very rare. I never found any tetrapod fossils when I was a kid. Yeah.
A question about your PhD then. What's that on specifically? And then how does that relate to your job in the Petrified Forest? Did they both come together? Did you have the space to say, I would like to work on these fossils that I can find in the in the forest? Yeah, the latter one.
Yeah, so how it kind of happened was I ended up going to UC Berkeley for my undergraduate back in 2012, after many years of high school just being obsessed with Triassic fossils. And when I went to UC Berkeley, my undergraduate advisor was Kevin Padian, who kind of specializes on Triassic tetrapod evolution. And he connected me with Petrified Forest National Park and the park paleontologist there, Bill Parker, who was the park paleontologist at that time. I was able to get an internship there in the summer when I was an undergraduate. And from that, I started this project looking at Triassic microvertebrates. I didn't really know what I was getting into. There hadn't been a ton of research done on microvertebrate sites from Petrified Forest National Park at that time. And so I started screen washing a site that we call the coprolite layer, so the poop layer, because it's a microvertebrate layer that's full of fossilized poop. And I started screen washing it and basically started seeing under the microscope from the concentrated screen washed rock, there were hundreds of bones of all sorts of animals, fish and tetrapods. And a lot of the morphotypes, the jaws that we were looking at, the different teeth, had never been described or reported. So kind of immediately, I realized that what I was looking at was something where there was a lot of research potential. And I didn't really know what that was at that time, but I could see that there was a lot of stuff that in these microvertebrate layers that was new. And so I kind of was hooked from that and wanted to figure out, what are all of these jaws? Which animals do they go to? What do all these bones represent in terms of diversity of different animals? And what is the ecosystem that produced all these bones? And so I then kept coming back for that internship at Petrified Forest National Park in the summers for many years. And then in 2019, then I got this seasonal ranger position to basically continue the research I'd been doing as a intern there. And so the rocks at Petrified Forest National Park, they're late Triassic in age, so between 225 and around 205 million years old. And they happen to be about the same age as the rocks that I initially was inspired to become a paleontologist from in Pennsylvania, which are also from the late Triassic. And a lot of the same animals were living in Pennsylvania and in Arizona at the same times. So the rocks I was looking at when I was a high schooler getting inspired to become a paleontologist turned out the same age rocks and the same kind of animals were what I got lucky enough to research as an undergrad. And then I was able to basically continue that research and turn that into a PhD project that I'm doing now.
Right. That's awesome. Perhaps giving away then what you found in all of this microvertebrate material, can we start by talking about Caecilians?
Sure.
So I want to know, what are they? And then what are the characteristics? What's the anatomy that defines what a Caecilian is?
Yeah. So what are Caecilians? This is a question I've gotten a lot since I've started to research these animals. When people think of, when most people think of living amphibians, they think of frogs and salamanders. That's what most of us are seeing every day around us, and they kind of live all over the globe, especially frogs, except for Antarctica. And people are much less familiar with what Caecilians are. And frankly, I was very unfamiliar beyond that they exist. I didn't know much about them until we discovered these fossil Caecilians at Petrified Forest. And so what are they? They're one of the three living groups of amphibians alongside frogs and salamanders. And they're very strange. They don't look a lot like frogs and salamanders. They're generally described as being worm-like, and a common name that they've been given is blind worms. And this is because they have they kind of look like a worm if you were to see one. They have an elongate tubular body and a kind of bullet-shaped head that is not really differentiated from the body very much. And they do not have limbs. They're limbless, like a snake. And they're called blind worms because most of them have reduced eyes, or their eyes are completely covered over by skin and or bone. And they have a lot of very strange and unique features amongst living tetrapods. So all living ones have a tentacle organ, and the tentacular organ basically sits below the eye, and it looks like a little tentacle that sticks out from the skull. And this is a organ that's unique to Sicilians that helps with chemoreception, taste and smell when they're burrowing underground. They have many other unique features. Many of the living ones, and ancestrally, they have double rows of teeth on their upper and lower jaws. So two parallel rows, as if, like, if we were a Sicilian, we'd have our main row of teeth, and then we'd have one parallel to it just inside of the mouth.
Something I'm going to admit now, and yeah, this is going to go in. When you said that they were what was it, blind worms or something?
Yeah,
I was there. Like, I thought surely everyone would know them as worm lizards, and then I was like, hey, let me Google that. And those are amphisbenians.
Yep.
And those are reptiles.
Yep.
But Sicilians are amphibians, but they sort of look the same.
They look very similar, and that's kind of a uniting theme in the evolution of tetrapods. Many different tetrapod groups have evolved to look very similar when they adapt to burrowing with their head underground. So many different groups of lizards have independently evolved this general body form. Also, many different groups of amphibians have done this. Sicilians and some salamanders, but also many different extinct groups of quote-unquote amphibians have independently evolved this body shape. And it basically, it's a series of adaptations that helps you burrow in the soil or leaf litter underground with your head. And you end up looking kind of like a worm, and you end up reducing the size of your eyes and fusing up a lot of the bones in your skull, or losing bones in your skull. And all of these things help you with burrowing underground. It's also the reason that figuring out evolutionarily what Sicilians are has been rather difficult, because this convergent evolution has happened so many different times and so many different groups of tetrapods through time. It's made it very difficult to figure out which group of tetrapods are burrowing Sicilians have originated from.
Right. Yeah, I can see the problem with that. But what's the advantage of having this morphology and ecology? Why do they want to live this way? Why did all of these different animals, different groups, all decide, let's lose our legs, turn into a big snake, and live underground?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's happened many different times independently over maybe over the last 300 million years in many different groups. And you know, one reason for it is that burrowing underground and eating invertebrates, worms, and insects, it's a niche that is not commonly exploited by other tetrapod groups that are living on land, they're living in the water. But if you can burrow underground, it opens up a whole nother space for them to evolve in and to be especially specializing in eating invertebrates that live underground. Another reason that some of these groups, like Sicilians, might have made it to the present day over hundreds of millions of years and many pretty major Earth system changes and extinction events is that they live underground. So they might be protected from changes in climate and collapses of ecosystems that happen after after a mass extinction event. They might be able to survive through these events better than, say, like a large-bodied animal that's living above ground.
Yeah, it makes sense. We still have them alive today, and if so, where are they living and how diverse are they? Why have I never heard of them before?
Yeah, so a big reason that people are really not familiar with Sicilians is that they live underground. There are almost all of them live underground, and we don't see them very much. Even if you lived in a place where Sicilians live, you probably wouldn't see them unless you're literally digging up the earth and disturbing the earth, and then you might see one. But there are around 200 species of them known today of living Sicilians, and they live in tropical settings on the continents. So where the equator crosses over the continents basically is where they occur. So Central and South America, Central Africa, and Southeast Asia. And they're largely, well, they're really restricted to living in the tropics, so about 30 degrees north and south of the equator. And they appear to be really restricted to humid, wet settings. They're probably, of all living tetrapod groups, we know the least about Sicilians. And most of this is because of how they live their life. It's very difficult to observe them. We know very little about like their reproductive biology. For a lot of species of Sicilians that we know of, only a single specimen or maybe one or two specimens have ever been discovered that represent that species, because maybe they were accidentally encountered by a scientist. And that's all we know about them. There was a kind of an interesting study that I read about on biologists who were studying living Sicilians from the rainforests of Brazil, and they estimated that it takes them about 40 hours of digging in the rainforest soil with a shovel to find a single individual Sicilian of the species they were looking for. And oftentimes that individual is cut in half by their shovel and is dead. So that's 40 hours of time to find a possibly alive Sicilian of the species they're interested in, of just digging in the rainforest soil. So that's kind of an example of how difficult it is to find a lot of the different species of Sicilians. And new species of Sicilians are described usually every year, every other year. And it's very likely that there's a lot more diversity of them, especially in tropical rainforest settings in Southeast Asia, in Africa, in South America, where new species will likely be found in coming years. So are the 200 species that we know of now is probably an underestimate of their actual diversity.
Okay, and you've said like one of the limiting factors for where they can live is the moisture. So if I think of all the other amphibians I know of, they all have to lay their eggs in water, and they have a metamorphosis as well, with eggs to tadpoles to frogs, for instance. Do we know anything similar for Sicilians? Do they have to lay their eggs in water? Is it moist enough in the soil? And then do they go through any kind of metamorphosis, or is it just, you know, they're just little Sicilians?
Yeah. Most Sicilians lay their eggs in moist substrates. And that's also something we see in some groups of frogs and salamanders. And there's several different ways that Sicilians develop. Some of them are viviparous, so the live young develop inside the body of the parent and come out looking like a miniature form of the parent. Some other ones are oviparous, so they have eggs that hatch, that are laid, so there's multiple strategies for reproduction, but similar strategies are seen in frogs and salamanders also.
Wow.
And some really interesting tidbits about their reproduction and development in. So we don't know a lot about, well, there's only some examples where we have actually been able to observe reproduction and the raising of young for Sicilians, but for some living Sicilians, the young are nourished by feeding off the skin of their mothers. So when they're living underground in a burrow, the young periodically will basically feast on the mother's skin and tear all of it off and eat it for nutrients. And they have these specialized teeth that kind of look like a grapefruit spoon. They've kind of got like little serrations on the tips, and that's for scraping the skin off of the mother. And then later they develop teeth like the parents, which are more like sharp cones for eating insects. But as young, they have these teeth that are specialized for ripping off the mother's skin. They also are nourished by drinking a nutritious secretion from the a gland in the anus of their mother. So they have the very strange kind of unique ways of raising their young. But we only have a few examples where we've been able to observe this. So there's probably a lot we don't know about reproduction in Sicilians.
Yeah. Wow. I wouldn't have guessed any of that. Yeah. So that's fascinating. Like, I feel like I'm really having my eyes opened up to a whole new group of animals. So,
yeah.
So we've probably underestimated their diversity. But how does that look when we look at the fossil record? When do we first see them, and how good is their fossil record?
Yeah, so Sicilians have by far the poorest fossil record of any living group of tetrapods. There are only 11 occurrences prior to our discovery of fossil Sicilians in the entire fossil record. Which is a lot of why we know very little about their evolutionary history. And most of these occurrences, they were found through screen washing, so washing sediment from microvertebrate sites through screens, and what is found of them is mostly just a handful of vertebra, fragments of jaws, and there's only a couple of these 11 occurrences that are more than just fragmentary bits, and the most complete one. And also the oldest one prior to our work is Eosicilia micropoda, which is from the early Jurassic Kayenta formation in northern Arizona, which is around 183 million years old. And Eosicilia is the most skeletally complete fossil Sicilian. We get skulls and partial skeletons with limbs on them. And they were basically found in situ in the burrows that they were living in the Jurassic.
Yeah, 11 specimens, not even 11 species.
Yeah.
That's not a lot to go on to fit together all of Sicilian evolution.
Yeah, and all of those occurrences have been found in the last 50 years. And this is really the big factor that has prohibited us for a very long time from really forming a consensus on what Sicilians are evolutionarily, how they change through time anatomically, what their ecology is. This extremely poor fossil record has really obscured knowing almost anything about their evolution. And that's been the real confounding factor on understanding them. And it's also the reason that there's been a lot of kind of speculation upon what are Sicilians. Without having fossils older than the early Jurassic, it really is limited how much we can really firmly understand about their evolutionary history.
Okay, so why is the fossil record so poor? I mean, you look at it on the surface and you have things that are made out of bones with big, long, bony bodies, and then, you know, like a reinforced skull, and they're living in the ground. They're already buried. So shouldn't that mean that we get loads of the fossils? Why do we not have that many?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know the answer to that, but I have some hypotheses as to why. There is kind of a common pattern in the fossil record for small-bodied tetrapods, which have these kind of tiny, delicate bones. It makes them possibly difficult to fossilize. It's easy for those bones to be broken up if they got into like the energy of a river or something. Or maybe it's also because their bones are so small. It's actually a collecting bias from scientists, where it's just difficult to identify what layers of rock would we even look for a Sicilian in. You would never see a Sicilian fossil if you were walking out in the badlands of Arizona at Petrified Forest National Park, and you would never see a fossil Sicilian, even if it was on the surface in front of you, because their bones are a millimeter or two. You'd really need a microscope to see them. So even finding a site where a Sicilian would be is difficult. And so maybe it's a collection bias where scientists were not sampling in the right places and in the right ways to even find them if they were there. Maybe it's that Sicilians that are older than the early Jurassic, maybe they don't look like what we think a Sicilian should look like. And so maybe we've been finding them, but we don't know what they look like. Another big factor that I think is probably pretty important is that they're on Earth today, they're restricted to the tropics, humid tropical settings on the continents. And we see that same pattern reflected in their fossil record. Albeit that their fossil record is very sparse. There's only 11 occurrences, but all of those occur near the paleo equator. And for fossil Sicilians that are older than the Jurassic, then maybe we could hypothesize that they would be restricted to living in humid continental settings near the equator. Is there a record of rocks of that age to find them that's older than the Jurassic? And partially, the answer is no. We really don't have continental equatorially deposited sediments from between the late Triassic and the middle to late Permian. And so if Sicilians are restricted to living in that kind of setting, the rocks that would have preserved them are not exposed on Earth today or have been totally lost through plate tectonic action. And so maybe the record of them is kind of inaccessible.
And something I was just thinking of then while you were saying that is that you said about the Jurassic one being preserved in situ in its life habitat in a burrow. Mm-hmm. But wouldn't that necessitate that the soil is also preserved?
Yes, yeah.
Which is not very common to find, you know, like a whole soil.
Yeah, the ones, Eocecilia is kind of unique in a few ways. Its mode of preservation, we don't really find other Sicilian fossils like that. They're found as disarticulated bits from screen washing of like deposits where the bones got transported somewhere after the animal died. Whereas Eocecilia, these skeletons are of animals that probably died in their burrows and are kind of preserved in situ. It's also kind of unique because, unlike other Sicilians, it's living in the tropics, but it's in a more arid setting. It's preserved in kind of intradunal oases. So generally that area of Arizona was sand dunes and was very arid. And Io Sicilia is living in kind of wet areas in between these dunes. And so it might suggest that early Sicilians had a wider range of climates and environmental settings that they could live in. And later they've kind of been restricted to this more equatorial humid setting. It, also important to remember, is that early Sicilians, like Io Sicilia, like Funcus firmus that we're talking about here, they have limbs. And so they also might be less restricted for dispersal. Maybe they could disperse better than living Sicilians that do not have limbs.
So this one from the early Jurassic is the first that you know, but then you've said that you don't really know what they might look like before that. Why do you think there is a before that? Surely the first one that we find in the early Jurassic is the start of the story. Why should we be looking any further back in time?
Yes. So this one from the early Jurassic Io Sicilia, that is the first fossil that basically everyone agrees is a Sicilian. But there are other fossil animals that are older than the early Jurassic that have been proposed as being early Sicilians or the sister group to Sicilians. So they're very close relatives. All of those have been very controversial, and the evidence is kind of shaky. And so Io Sicilia is the first thing that everyone agrees, okay, that has a lot of these really specialized adaptations that we only see in living Sicilians. Everyone agrees that is a Sicilian.
Right. And has it been estimated when they could have evolved?
Yes. Molecular clock estimates with fossil calibrations have estimated that Sicilians diverged from other amphibians, so frogs and salamanders, from the latest Devonian all the way to the middle Permian. So that's almost 200 million years of time. So that's a really wide range in which these molecular clock estimates have been placing this origin of Sicilians. And so that kind of demonstrates how little we know and how large the error bars are on when Sicilians might have evolved. So if we take those molecular clock estimates at face value, the gap, the ghost lineage between Io Sicilia, the oldest one everyone can agree on as a Sicilian, and their divergence could be from 70 million years to up to a 200 million year gap in time in which Sicilians should exist, and we have yet to find their fossils.
Is a huge gap, and it'd be lovely if someone could find something that helps plug that gap, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So are the ones that we know of, these 11 specimens, are they radically different to the modern ones? You said about the Jurassic one having legs, Io Sicilia.
Yeah, so only two of them are really different than the ones we know of today. And they're also the two oldest occurrences of Sicilians. So Io Sicilia, which we talked about, and also Rubrica Sicilia, which is from the early Cretaceous of Morocco, so around 145 million years old. And both Io Sicilia and Rubrica Sicilia, they both have limbs, which are then later lost in all later Sicilians. But in most other ways, they're fairly similar to other living Sicilians and have a lot of the specialized anatomies that we see in living Sicilians.
Okay, but with so few fossils, it must be hard to, or if not impossible, to kind of come up with a stepwise evolution or how they came to be Sicilians. So for instance, with the limbs, that's a very easy one to think that, yes, they have evolved from an amphibian with four limbs, and then eventually as they lost them and evolved this fossorial, this burrowing lifestyle, they became redundant. That's a nice, neat transition. But equally, they could have evolved from something that already had this snake-like body plan, and then just those early ones kind of went off and did their own thing and thought, you know what, actually, we might have our legs back, if that's okay. So it, can you come up with any kind of understanding of the evolutionary steps that got us to Sicilians?
Yeah, kind of. When Io Sicilia was the oldest known Sicilian, then there's this huge gap prior to that 70 to 200 million year ghost lineage. It left it so that you could really only propose different scenarios. So you could look at different groups of animals that have Sicilian-like features from the Carboniferous, from the Permian, that could be the sister group to Sicilians and to Io Sicilia. But it was really impossible to narrow that down to one specific group that would allow you to look at the stepwise evolution of the group. So you would have to pose different scenarios depending on what group you thought Sicilians belonged to, and then you could propose a trajectory of how they evolved through time. But the big issue is that these different hypotheses are kind of mutually exclusive. So if the Sicilians are from, if they could be from three different groups of animals, then you have to propose a different trajectory of stepwise evolution depending on which group they evolved from.
Right, okay. So then how does this fit into the larger groups? So we know amphibians, but I was having a problem, I was telling you about this, with amphibians and lissamphibians. So yeah. What are the definitions of each, and what's the difference between each group?
Yeah. So lissamphibians are living groups of amphibians. So it's frogs, salamanders, and Sicilians. The term amphibian is a much more kind of squishy term. In Greek, it means both kinds of life, which refers to land and water. This is something that's shared by living amphibians. So they need to lay their eggs in water or in moist substrates. They lack an amniotic egg. But when we leave the present and look back at the long history of tetrapods, it turns out that the term amphibian is a paraphyletic term. So it doesn't refer to like a natural monophyletic evolutionary group. And traditionally, how the term amphibian has been used is to refer to all non-amniote tetrapods, so tetrapods that do not have an amniotic egg. So that means that amphibians, extinct amphibians, had a larval stage that lived in water and underwent metamorphosis. Therefore, it includes a bunch of different extinct groups, not all of which do we totally know what their evolutionary placement is in the tree of tetrapod life. But amphibians are considered, the term amphibian is considered to even include like the earliest tetrapodomorphs and early tetrapods like Tiktaalik.
Okay, so from the moment that something crawled out and of the water, it was a tetrapod. We got four limbs. Hooray, we're on land now. Congratulations. Yeah. And eventually, you would get all the different forms, and that would lead up to an amniote would eventually evolve. And the amniotes are a distinct group. But everything in between, in the lead up to the amniotes, that is kind of
called amphibians, even if it's not really a definitive thing. It's just
exactly. Yeah. It's more of like a term that describes a lifestyle. And it does not refer to a distinct evolutionary group. Yeah.
But lissamphibians are going to be a distinct group.
Yes, they are a distinct group, and the three groups of living amphibians, frogs, salamanders, and Sicilians, and everything that is more closely related to them, or that's nested within those three lineages.
Okay. And when do we see the first lissamphibians in the fossil record?
So the oldest lissamphibian that everyone agrees upon is Triadobatrachus, which is from Morocco, from the early Triassic. It's about 250 million years old, and it's been called kind of a proto-frog. And so it's the earliest representative of Salentia, so the group that includes living frogs and toads.
Okay. And do they have a similar, like, yeah, so if we've got estimates for Sicilians being as far back as even the Devonian, then that would necessitate, because they're part of the Lissamphibians, that the Lissamphibians must have evolved in the Devonian as well, potentially, or maybe even further back.
Yeah, exactly. Although Triadobatrachus shows up in the early Triassic, as with Sicilians, or it's the divergence of frogs from Sicilians probably occurred in from the Permian, or estimates place it in from the Permian all the way back to the Carboniferous and possibly the latest Devonian. So it's the same issue that we have with Sicilians. When do frogs diverge from Sicilians and from salamanders? We see the earliest frog in the early Triassic 250 million years ago, but there's likely a very long ghost lineage before that.
Okay. And so why are Sicilians so important to our understanding of the origins of the wider group, the Lissamphibians?
Yeah, so the what a Lissamphibian is kind of hinges upon the evolutionary placement of Sicilians. So of living amphibians, there's a consensus across the scientific community that salamanders and frogs are sister groups. They're each other's closest relatives, and they form the group Batrachia. So that's frogs and salamanders. And whereas Sicilians, it's been proposed that Sicilians are then the sister group to Batrachians, so the closest relatives to salamanders and frogs. But there's several other hypotheses of what Sicilians might be. Historically, they were first proposed by Romer to Sicilians and frogs and salamanders to have multiple origins within this kind of strange group of Carboniferous and Permian tetrapods called the Lepispondyls. And many Lepispondyls evolve elongate bodies. They fuse up bones in their skull, and they lose other bones in their skull. And some of these patterns are similar to patterns we see in the evolution of early Lissamphibians. And so that was kind of the original idea of what Lissamphibians might have evolved from. And then that kind of changed in the 1960s with the discovery of Dolaserpiton, which is a Dicerophoid temnospondyl amphibian from the Permian of Oklahoma. And Dolaserpiton has a lot of features shared with frogs and salamanders, but also a lot of really unique features that are shared with Sicilians. And it kind of changed our ideas of what amphibians might be. And that was the first time that we started to think, okay, maybe all amphibians are actually, or all living amphibians, frogs, salamanders, and Sicilians are closely related to each other. Their ancestor or close relative in the Permian was something like Dolaserpiton. More recently, another hypothesis has been proposed for what Sicilians might be, and that's that They are derived from stereospondyl temnospondyls, which is a group of temnospondyl amphibians. So these mostly large-bodied, kind of, they look like a giant salamander that were living in the Permian and the Triassic. And there's certain features that Sicilians share with a group of stereospondyls that evolved to become fossorial, so burrowing, in the late Triassic. And so that was very recently proposed as a new hypothesis for what where Sicilians might come from. And so there's all these different hypotheses for the origins of Sicilians and the origins of frogs and salamanders. And each one means something very different. So if Sicilians are actually stereospondyl temnospondyls, it means that Lysamphibia, the group, the total group Lysamphibia, includes a bunch of extinct different types of temnospondyl amphibians. Whereas if Sicilians are actually the sister group to salamanders and frogs, it kind of narrows what a Lysamphibian is to just those exclusive groups. So the changing placement of Sicilians on the Tree of Life changes what other groups are included in Lysamphibia. It also changes our understanding of the timing of tetrapod evolution. So if Sicilians are related to a group that's distantly related to frogs and salamanders, it means that they evolved much older, whereas or they diverged from frogs and salamanders at a much older time. Whereas if they're closer relatives to each other or sister groups, they might have evolved much later. So it kind of changes how we time the evolution of different tetrapod groups.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really lovely explanation as to how these little changes in a tree, they might not look like anything huge, but they have huge like permutations and ramifications for our understanding and definitions of different groups and the timings of events. So there's so much of, you know, what's this house of cards that's built of an understanding of the evolutionary history of a group that, yeah, you make one little change and all of a sudden your house of cards is upside down. And yeah, it's
totally, yeah,
it's crazy. So something like a new fossil, a new species, could really change everything. And so when you have recently described Fungus vermis gilmori, is really going to help us understand this evolution. So first of all, I want to know, where did the name Fungus vermis come from? Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. But the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.